Goddag og velkommen til Langsomme Samtaler. Mit navn er Rune Lykkeberg. Vi kører her efter det amerikanske præsidentvalg og Trumps genkomst som normalen i amerikansk politik. Et par uger, hvor vi forsøger at finde ud af, hvad var det egentlig, der skete, og hvad skal der ske fremad? Både hvad kan Trump finde på, hvad kommer han af, hvor kommer den folkelige opbakning til ham fra, og hvad er demokraternes, de progressive og venstrefløjens modsvar? Og i den forbindelse er der nærmest ingen, jeg hellere ville tale med, end den amerikanske sociolog Arlie Hochschild. Hun skrev for nogle år siden bogen Strangers in Their Own Land, hvor hun havde boet i flere år sammen med Trump-vælgere i en sydstat, og lærte dem at kende og kom dybt ind i deres verden, og forstod, at der grundlæggende er det, hun kalder for en deep story, altså en følelsesmæssig fortælling, som bestemmer deres politiske verdensbillede. Og det er ikke sådan, at den følelsesmæssige fortælling er en slags metafysik, der er helt afkoblet fra politik. Men den interagerer med politikken, og den er med til at bestemme, hvordan man opfatter politikken. Og hvis man ikke kan gå igennem den deep story, så kommer man aldrig nogensinde frem til at lave noget om. Kort fortalt var the deep story hos Trump-vælgerne i Strangers in Their Own Land, at der er en meget stor gruppe af amerikanere, fortrinsvis den lavere middelklasse, fortrinsvis mænd, som hele deres liv har følt, at de stod i kø til den amerikanske drøm. De kunne se det skinnende hus på toppen af bjerget, som var drømmen, og de synes, de havde gjort deres, passet deres arbejde, plejet deres familie, levet et ordentligt liv, og stod i kø, og stod i kø, og stod i kø, samtidig med, at de kunne se, at der kom mere og mere guld på toppen af bjerget. Og foran dem i køen var der alle mulige andre, der kom ind. Kvinder kom ind på positiv særbehandling, oplevede de. Sorte kom ind. Asiater kom ind på eliteuniversiteterne. Latinos nede fra Mellemamerika kom ind. Og under præsident Barack Obamas tid i Det Hvide Hus blev det ligefrem gjort til en præstation, at der var andre, der var kommet tættere på den amerikanske drøm. Så det var oplevelsen af at tro på noget, som man, hvor man selv blev sat tilbage, selvom man gjorde det rigtige. Oplevelsen af en grunduretfærdighed, som motiverede hele opbakningen til Trump-kampagnen 2016. Nu har Arlie Hochschild været tilbage. Hun har været tilbage i en lille bitte industriby, der hedder Pikesville i Kentucky, hvor der bor 7.000 mennesker. Og hun har været hos dem i meget lang tid, talt med dem, levet med dem, rejst rundt med dem, set deres arbejdsliv og delt deres bekymringer, tanker og drømme. Det er der kommet en helt fantastisk ny bog ud af, som hedder Stolen Pride. Så efter Trump vandt, var det helt oplagt, at vi ville meget, meget gerne tale med Arlie Hochschild, og også tale med hende om, hvordan kan andre nå frem til de vælgere. Og det kan jeg love, det kommer der nogle solide bud på undervejs i samtalen. Arlie Hochschild er professor ved Berkeley i San Francisco, som altså er et meget liberalt universitet. Hun er 84 år gammel, så hun har altså set lidt af hvert i sit liv. Og hun starter med at fortælle, hvilken fase i hendes liv, det der lige er sket, det minder hende om. Her følger min samtale med den fantastiske Arlie Hochschild.
Thank you so much for your work. It's been very important to us here in Denmark. Strangers in Their Own Land has really been referred to a lot. We've used it a lot here in this newspaper. And Stolen Pride will be read a lot here. And you know, even the work that you did before that about mental load had also been influential. So you have a big audience here.
Oh, good.
I want to ask you first about how you feel after the election, because most people I know in America have friends that are Trump supporters that I've met on my research trips there that I'm writing with. And they're ecstatic. But most of my liberal friends are really saddened, and saddened in a way that they weren't in 2016, where there was this eruption of resistance. But there's more like in my sense is that there's more like an atmosphere of resignation, or what can we do about it? And so there's a sadness among a lot of people I know. How do you feel after the election?
Well, I feel like I'm going through the five stages of grief. I don't feel stunned like a lot of people. I've been studying this thing, so it's not a surprise. In fact, I've been worried about this for two books now. But How do I feel? I feel after the kind of thud, I feel like I am going back in my life to a time in the 1960s when we felt on the opposite side of the American government with the war in Vietnam. And so that one has to join an opposition. One has to be organized and but also outreaching, but you have to hold, there's a job to do. So I'm not discouraged. I'm not one of these people that's getting an airplane flight to New Zealand. In fact, I'm writing my New Zealand friends, come home, we need you. So you could say that in a quiet way, I'm trying to mobilize my strength.
I'm not surprised that Trump won. We all knew that this could happen, that it was somewhat likely. But I was not expecting this version of Trump, this kind of Elon Musk alliance, which is very different from what we saw in the summer with the Republican convention, which was more like a working class populism. You had the man from Teamsters doing his speech. But it's this kind of oligarchy takeover with Elon Musk is really surprising to me. How is that to you?
Yes. It's surprising to me, too. It's an addition to what you say, the working class appeal. Of his convention and kind of appealing to the lowest common denominator of that. I mean, any working class people were kind of insulted at how low that appeal went. But of course, he's very canny. And in a way, I think we have to talk about this being a takeover, and we will see one provocation after another. That's how Donald Trump operates. And I believe we have to crack the code of that provocation by understanding the emotions to which he appeals. And people are giving him a pass and presuming that this is all in their interest. And he is making and planning a serious transfer of power, I think. So this is very, very serious. And it is all done with a lightheartedness and bravado that throws people off. They don't think he's as serious as he really is, with Elon Musk, for example, at his side and wanting to cut the government. It's a very serious thing. So I guess my question, the one that I'm always thinking about, is this question of popular consent. How is he getting away with this? What do his followers feel? Now, that's not the only question to ask, but I think it's an important one because this man has been brought to us by the ballot box. And so I can go into my explanation as to what brought us to this moment. And there are long-term failures on part of the Democratic Party, and that it's paying for now. But I guess what this has all led me to want to understand is, the consent, why people feel good about him.
I think you've been very helpful in your work helping us understand the consent and the basis of his, with your going into the emotions of a part of his electorate, two parts of his electorate, actually. And when he was first elected, I think many of us felt that all those books of political science were not helpful to us. but your books were. Can you tell us a little bit about the approach that you chose, that you describe in the opening pages of Strangers in Their Own Land, yet that you wanted to understand the emotions that underlie politics?
Right. I do, because they feel always important, but now I feel like in this case, they're the kind of main show that unless what I'm trying to do in my books is to help my readers become bilingual in the sense of we can speak rationality, right? But we can't speak and we can't hear emotional life. And emotional life has a narrative. And paradoxically, I'm trying to get us to rationally think about the power of emotion. That is what my books do. And to have us all do a mega think on the power of emotion. And there are some historical situations in which emotion is not a primary, or it doesn't lead to consequential actions. And there are other moments in history where it's really the main show. And so what I do as an analyst is walk it backwards. You go to a Donald Trump rally and you see angry people with signs, and they feel together with others. And there's an elation at being together with others who are angry. At that point, you can do one of two things. You can say, oh, that's terrible. They're silly people. They're uneducated people. And they're making bad choices. Or you can sit down with me and say, okay, let's walk it backwards. These are people just like you and me, only in a certain state. They're mad now. What's making them mad? Walk it backwards. They're perfectly nice people who are mad. And what are they mad at? And underneath the anger, what are they feeling? Are they feeling lost? Are they feeling panicked? Are they feeling ashamed? And basically, that's what I ran it to. I felt, and then the question becomes, being rational about feelings again, how does Donald Trump prey on feelings of shame? So backing up, the big story is that over the last 2 months, Democratic Party and Republican Party turned a blind eye with NAFTA to the effect of offshoring and automation on blue-collar whites, 42% of America, and they took a hit. This is the backstory. There's been a downward mobility of this major ethnic group over the last 2 and 3 decades. And this is not in my book. This is Raj Chetty's research, Harvard economist. So this downward mobility, this major blue collar, so we're talking non-bachelor's degree whites, that group downwardly mobile over time, inflation eating away, progress. And both absolutely and relative to whites with BAs and relative to blacks with or without BAs. So you've got that happening, number one. Then you have Biden opening the door to migrants or not having an adequate policy dealing with immigrants. So you have this kind of group, and I'm focusing on the men in it, who are the base of MAGA, white, blue-collar men, who are feeling, what are they feeling? Before they're mad, what are they feeling? They're feeling frightened and shamed. Why aren't I making it to the American dream the way my father did? And why has my wife left me? Why I've gotten on drugs and I'm in rehab and I'm ashamed of it. You know, all of those feelings. So we're climbing into the mental state of a person who's doesn't feel successful relative to their parents and who is frightened that the women are coming in, ethnic minorities are coming in. They feel a sense of both shame and panic. So next thing to look at is how Donald Trump, instead of wanting to fix it the way Joe Biden did, hey, let's get some economic policies that could actually turn this around and address the problems you really do have. Donald Trump has said, how can I prospect your shame? He's like a coal miner. He prospects it. He understands just where it is and how it hurts, because I think he's a shamed guy himself. And that would be neither here nor there, a personal story, a very harsh, judgmental, unforgiving father whom he could never please. He might have had a learning disability that he's compensating for. We don't know. And we wouldn't care, except that it's given him great insight into the feeling, I think, of shame, which turns out whole blue-collar sector, for the reasons we've just looked at, is worried about shame. Either they are feeling it or they're worried, oh my goodness, things don't look good for me. And the Democratic Party is not saying we get how you feel. We understand. You've been going down. The Democratic Party and Harris is telling you, oh no, up, look, be joyous, joy, joy, joy. That's not going to sound right to people who are frightened of being shamed. So his dark appeal worked on a lot of people. And I think my major contribution here is to say, first of all, this is the main story. Think about it. And second, to say that he's working his way, and it's going on as we speak, in a four-moment anti-shaming ritual that he replays event after event. So you can watch it. There'll be something else and he'll run it through these four moments emotionally. And the moments are, moment one, he says something provocative. Immigrants are eating your pet cats and dogs. Moment two, the punditry shames Donald Trump for saying the provocative thing. Oh, you can't say that. It's a lie. It was just written, but it wasn't true. You don't repeat a lie. Okay. That's moment two. The punditry shames Donald Trump. Moment three, Donald Trump becomes the victim of the shaming punditry. Oh, how hard it is when people are at you and they're accusing you and they're suing you and nothing you can do gets them off your back. Do you know how that feels? You feel that way too, don't you? Aren't they doing that to you? Well, yes, they're doing it to me and you together, and I'm taking the hit. This is all emotional. This is the logic of emotion at work. Moment three. And moment four, Donald Trump roars back at the punditry and all the shamers. I am rising up. I am powerful. I can overcome. I can be a bully against the shamers. I will put them back in their place. So I think that's the one, two, three, four. And that the liberals in America, that half of America that voted for Joe Biden, or sorry, for Harris, listens to moment one and two. oh, he says something provocative and you've shamed him, and that's the only thing you can do with such a shameful person. And that the Trump half of America listens to moment three and moment four. That is Donald Trump, the victim of the shamers, poor guy. Look how they're attacking him. And four, his revenge. So you have this one, two, three, four ritual almost weekly. We're not reading the whole thing. And to the extent we are, we're reading it differently, the different parts of America. So, yeah, that's what I think's important. And that's why I'm focusing on it.
I was reading your book a couple of months ago and recognizing this mechanism. And you even add the fifth element in the book the second time you mention it, where he kind of cleans up the state. And I was watching some of his rallies when I was covering the American election through that prism. And when you saw him with, you know, the Arnold Palmer story, where he was talking about Arnold Palmer's genitalia at a rally, it was all, he said almost, I know I shouldn't say this. You know, he was aware that now he was doing something provocative. And you could see his audience was laughing in advance, like they knew he's going to give it to us now. And afterwards, he was saying, oh, I shouldn't have said that. And they loved it. So it was almost like a ritual with him and his crowds. And they were anticipating together the response from the liberal media. And I was, having read your book, I was thinking, well, how should the liberal media respond? You know, how would you just let it go? Or because, you know, it's what you call deep story that just is confirming of a collective here. And I was thinking, how do you respond to these deep stories with policies? I know that's a big question.
Well, policies is one way, but devising a counter narrative that speaks to feelings is another way, and they're totally compatible. What if Harris, Biden had said, instead of this one, two, three, four, let's look at what the one, two, three, four makes us feel and who it leads us to blame. Do we have 1 billionaire or two or billionaire class that wants to cut taxes and services for the very group that is now laughing at Donald Trump's jokes? Isn't this a big hoax? Isn't he getting us mad at the wrong people? So as not to be mad at the untaxed super rich, a class to which he's adding. So exposing the story and exposing how you have billionaires trying to get the lower middle class mad at the upper middle class. Well, wait a minute. You know, this is a blame game that it's really worth looking at. How does Elon Musk and Donald Trump get off so fast? Do they really have the welfare of majority of Americans? Are they getting us mad at each other? Is this the game?
When I was reading your book, it struck me how important the identity politics of the left is for many of the voters. And I've been hearing that too, talking to Trump voters. And I think, how can these transgender rights be such an existential issue? How can the question of women or men in women's sports, and you know, how can this be so important that instead of looking at the billionaire Republican class, they see a kind of liberal upper class as their almost class adversary, as we say in European class studies that I know you're familiar with. How do you explain the fact that this liberal academic upper class or cultural upper class has become such a strong adversary for the Trump right, which is shared by a lot of his voters?
Right. That's right. In other words, we can say Trump has redirected shame to rage, shame to blame, and redirected blame from the billionaire class to the upper middle class. People, what's that? People with degrees, with a BA, an MA, MD, a kind of a licensed class that isn't that much better off than you are, you know, but it's got more pride than you do. So it's the fetishism of small differences. And so how we can stand back and say, wait a minute, you're being had. These super rich people are reducing taxes on themselves and saying it's in your interest and in your interest to reduce any government transfers to you. How is this accomplished? Well, I think it's accomplished by part of the answer to that question is exploiting real deficits and problems on the Democratic side. In other words, the Democratic Party has been completely inadequate in its rhetoric and its main message to the white working class. And to the white working class, what it hears from the Democratic Party is, oh, you people are racists. Oh, you people are homophobic. Oh, you people are sexist. Why aren't you happy with what you've got? And we, the government, we're virtuous to be reaching out to you. Don't you get it? Aren't you happy? And that's just not adequate. In other words, it needs another emotional narrative, which includes saying, we get how it feels to strive for the American dream, but not be able to get to it. Your dad strove for it. Your granddad did. They were coal miners. They did well, did better than their parents had. They felt proud. They suffered, but they were heroic in that suffering. And you don't get to feel that way. So the Democratic Party needs to say, I know about loss, going down. We get it, and it feels terrible. But let's open up that American dream and offer, in a way, pride and well-being to a variety of people. And we may not need a BA degree to get to pride, you know? Aren't there other avenues? We're experimenting with that. But if the Democratic Party say, look, we're not forgetting you, we're addressing you. I don't think that the Harris campaign did that. It looked like, and similarly with Hillary, like be happy, you know, we're successful, strive the American dream. And when people are cut out of the American dream and they're being told to be happy about getting the American dream or having the chance to get it, it doesn't work. So there needs to be some good thinking that's based on a bilingual understanding of emotions as well as rationality. The Democratic Party failed in this regard. So I'm looking forward to it retooling itself. In other words, the people I came to know and wrote about in Stolen Pride didn't feel seen. There was one guy you may remember, David Maynard, who said, look, I'm poor, I'm dumb, I'm trailer trash, okay? But there's no narrative for me. I don't feel seen. There's one narrative for the white middle class, and you say, well, good for you. If you're middle class and you're white, you must have really worked hard and you deserve pride. Good for you. And the black poor, well, what happened to you is you were hit by racism. And we understand that. So they have a narrative too. It's not because you're lazy, it's because of racism. But if I am white and poor, why, if I'm so privileged to be white, am I poor? Must be because I'm dumb or I'm lazy. And that's not a source of pride, or pride starved. So that was the vulnerability that Donald Trump has drilled into.
And I think when I read your book, I was thinking that this is not just to put blame on the Democratic Party. This is kind of the failure on a lot of liberal America, because I could easily see the movie about Kamala Harris winning the election. You know, growing up in the 60s, daughter of immigrants, part of the civil rights movement, and she became a young, successful lawyer, and she was the district attorney, and then all the way to the top. But I was thinking of that with your source David here, and I couldn't see the other story. This is not part of the Hollywood narrative, or you know, the audience that sees Hamilton, seen Hamilton 10 years in a row now during the Trump period. They've been celebrating Alexander Hamilton, the great academic aristocrat who was against James Madison and wanted the Senate and not the state democracy. You know, I feel that there's a liberal narrative that's not just in the Democratic Party, but that's rooted in their own very, very economically strong cultural industry as well. And I really understand why the people in your books, they don't feel reflected in that.
Yes, I think you've said it very well. That's right. That's right. There's no heroic story of rise. And that's the story that they are primed to look for, you know. So it was poignant to me to see what stories people did devise for themselves to feel good. They would say, well, we're not divorced. You know, my mother was divorced, and later on, you know, my father got divorced, but I love my husband and we're happy together. And that's our American dream. There was a man who said, I've always wanted to build a house. And I like the Amish, very simple, exquisite kind of taste, but simplicity being one principle of that aesthetic. And I'd like to build a house like that. Now, he didn't actually get there, but that was his American dream. So you saw a kind of a dignity-seeking downsizing of the American dream. Well, let's talk about that. Let's, you know, let's not laugh at it. Let's not ignore it. Let's not make all our heroes women and Blacks and gays. There are people who are not women, and they're not Black, and they're not gay, but they are a majority group ethnically and in culturally, and they feel ignored. Now, if they were a smaller group and felt ignored, we wouldn't be in the situation we are, but they are a big group. And Donald Trump has gotten others to identify with the crisis of the ignored and stuck. He is the president of the ignored and the stuck. And of course, the left has always imagined itself as the champion of the ignored and the stuck. That's why liberals, a lot of liberals are liberal because of that. And so what a paradox that the real theft here is a cultural theft by the right of the left.
I think there's another interesting fact in your book, which I didn't know, where you say that liberals are more inclined to cut off conservatives than conservatives are to liberals. And it's interesting because when I've been traveling as a journalist in the US, Trump voters really like talking to a European liberal because they like to explain to someone who's outside. They really, you know, I have great friends. They invite us home for dinner. Very, very friendly people. And it's not just that they're friendly, because anybody could be friendly. They really like to explain themselves. And they feel they need to explain themselves. And they always say they don't get the chance to explain themselves in an American context.
That is so fascinating to me. That is really fascinating to me. And in a way, as I fit myself into that category too, they almost think of me as a foreigner. Well, you're from Berkeley, California. Well, you come from another culture. And you're curious about me. Okay, let me tell you about me. But that's poignant. Something's wrong that they need to explain themselves to us. So, you know, let's just pause at that moment. Why are they so hungry for an audience? And they feel actually, this points to Hollywood too, I think, that the toxic white male has a little bit been overplayed. And they're looking for heroic figures that resemble themselves.
And another thing that's very striking for me as a European reading your work is the presence of the American dream, that there is an enormous normative power in your country, which we don't have as explicit in Europe. You know, we wouldn't have the dream of the welfare state here in Denmark. You know, you can't say that. People can be angry if they watch poor people in the streets because we pay half of our income in taxes. But we don't have that basic national promise that you have. And it seems that this promise of the American dream is actually driving a lot, both positive but also negative things in America.
In other words, if you're Danish, you don't grow up with the idea that you have to do it yourself to get to an impossible goal. Maybe it's that. I guess one thing I discovered in talking to people in Appalachia was this pride paradox. In a way, it's very strange. I began to see that not only in this region were people suffering economic loss, they were blaming themselves for it. They were feeling, if I succeed, it's because I worked hard, I was determined, I never gave up. Good for me. But if I fail, that is, if the coal mine closed and there were no good jobs around, and I had to leave for a nearby industrial city, Cincinnati, and got a job at half the pay. If I fail, that's on me too. That's my fault, because there's a high degree of faith in the individual, what we call individualism. And I think that's a cultural difference between Denmark and the United States. US is really good at blaming the individual and giving credit to the individual. Okay, so the pride paradox, just to back up, is that you're taking an economic hit. You've lost something, and you're blaming yourself for it because you're focusing on the individual. What makes that a paradox, though, is that, or poignant anyway, is that over in the blue states where there's economic good news, you have people who have a more circumstantial culture of pride. And they say, well, they take a sociology class that says, you know what, there is a sector that's gone down and it's not your fault, you know, or you were born into a class that has a lower chance of success. It's not your fault. It's circumstances. So on the what a sad thing. But if you are in the center of the pride paradox. You're in a situation of loss and blame yourself for it. You are a sitting duck for an ideologue and charismatic figure who comes along and says, oh, you're feeling bad. They caused you to feel bad. Shame to blame. And that is Trumpism. That's what it does. It takes the raw material of shame and reshapes it into blame and accusation and looking for villains. That's dangerous, terribly, terribly dangerous.
I have just one more question, which is about COVID, because I think when I was in Pennsylvania for 3 weeks before the election, and it struck me that COVID is a lot more present in America than it is in Europe. And there's a lot of, it seems to me that the Democrats who learned, we can't call them deplorables anymore, but they've kind of repeated a civilizational shaming campaign against those who wouldn't wear face masks or those who wouldn't properly distance. And here, actually, you know, the Republicans are on the same side as we are in Denmark. You know, we would have the same policies in the end of COVID as Ron DeSantis would have in Florida, or Brian Kemp would have in Georgia. So I would hear, this would be a very strange experience, that I would feel in agreement with the Republicans, and I would feel that the Democratic shaming campaign was too much. And I would feel that the Republicans were right when they said, well, you can't close down schools for such a long time. You can't close down churches, bowling alleys. Churches are not so important here. But and I felt that there was a lot of things in America, the mechanisms, the shame to blame, the pride paradox, the mechanism that you're describing, that have been accelerated by the COVID experience. And the inflation is a lot worse for you because you put so much emphasis on individual responsibility for your economic performance. So how do you think, is this, are we in the aftermath of COVID still?
That's true. And if we add a whole series of bad news things from 2008, actually the working class and poor were hit harder. And with climate change, you know, that can happen in red states and blue states. But if you're in a blue state or you're a blue collar guy, you don't have insurance on your house. So it's a bigger loss. So COVID, same thing. You're harder hit. If you don't get inoculations or you're opposed to it, you know, you have a higher death rate, actually. So this isn't quite the point you were making, but I want to say a lot of things have happened to the general population that hit the white working class harder and make them more anxious that things are not going right, and that exacerbate a kind of predisposition to accept a right-wing charismatic leader. I'm again focusing on the feelings, but you're right. What your point is that actually the government did overplay its hand and was lordly, and this then was glommed onto as evidence that the Democrats don't, you know, they're arrogant.
Well, absent one last question, you can answer that very briefly, which is, we have a lot of people here saying, if only Bernie Sanders would have won in 2016, if only, because Bernie wasn't about identity politics, Bernie was about class politics, Bernie understood, the 2016 Bernie understood migration, he understood everything. So if only Bernie had won. Do you think, and I'm not going to ask you if it would, everything would have put, but do you think that the people that you've spoken to, that they would have been, that would Bernie Sanders have had an appeal to them? Would he have been, you know, a better advocate for them?
Yes. And they'll say that. There is a Trump-Bernie crossover, curious as it sounds. People that voted for Trump were also attracted to Bernie. It's kind of a tragic, strange thing to think about. But he didn't succeed in appealing to the white working class because of the scare word of socialism, and this is a marginal, you're not a real American unless you can, you know, open your own little store and make it from the bottom. But yeah, he had appeal. He had appeal. Also, environmentalism has an appeal. Right there in Trump land, I met people who were looking at these sawed-off mountains in Kentucky, sawed off because some machine was grabbing coal out of the center of the mountain, left it devastated. And people were saying, you know, it'd be nice to have a solar panel on top of that sawed-off mountain. So I see, you know, to be goody-goody about it, I see some opportunities of crossover left to right on issues, on the fact, for example, that Biden has, through the Inflation Reduction Act, put a lot of resources into red states for putting renewable energy up. And that brings jobs. And now Donald Trump is probably going to run and say, oh, no, that was a Biden idea, bad idea. We don't need that. We just need to drill oil and coal. A lot of people say, no, Biden was right to give us jobs doing something we know is good. We'd like to hold on to that. So I think the left has an opportunity. Okay, this is maybe not going to be a main thread, but I think it would be a very good thing for the left to come say, look, you know, we've had our eyes closed. This is really sorry, eating a little humble pie, but, you know, we're worried about the earth, all these storms, and there is something we can do about it. There are these good jobs in red states. We're all for it. Can we come together on that? I think it's an opportunity.
That's a wonderful place to end. Ali Hochschild, your work has been so important to us. Thank you for talking to us here. It feels like a very dark hour, but it's a pleasure and it's encouraging to talk to you. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Rune. It was really fun to talk. Good luck.
Thank you. Good luck to you as well.
I'll need it.
Yeah.
Det var så min samtale med Ali Hochschild, og den bog, vi talte om, hedder Stolen Pride. Den anden bog, vi talte om, hedder Strangers in Their Own Land. Jeg kan varmt anbefale dem begge to. Den her langsom samtale var ligesom de foregående, redigeret, produceret og sat sammen til det, I har lyttet til, af vores helt vidunderlige venner hjælper Samuel Krog. I næste uge fortsætter vi med at dykke ned i, hvad fanden det egentlig var, der skete. Jeg ved ikke, hvem vi taler med, og hvordan det kommer til at spille sig ud, men jeg kan love jer en ting. Det bliver interessant, fordi godt nok er det mørke og svære tider, vi står i, men det er også spændende og eventyrlige tider. Og mørket letter altså en lille smule, hvis man tillader sig selv at se på dramaet, det eventyrlige og alt det intellektuelt interessante. Mit navn er Rune Lykkeberg. Tak fordi I lyttede med.